Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott. This is Welcome to Florida. And the governor's back in the state, Craig, and you, after running maybe the least successful presidential primary campaign in modern history, where he started as a front runner, the chosen one, and got less and less popular as people became to know him more and more. But he's back in Florida, and you've got an environmental checklist, wish list, you hope he spends some time with now that he's not campaigning for higher office.
Well, you know, they say home is the place where when you go there, they have to take you in. So he's come back to Florida, his native state and the place where he's supposed to be working for the taxpayers. And so I said, you know, basically, welcome back. Your campaign was such a disaster that you're now less popular in Florida than you were when you got reelected. And so here are some things you can do to regain your popularity. The environment is a hugely popular issue in Florida. Every time it's on the ballot, it gets like 70-80% of the vote. So you need to work on some environmental issues in order to regain your popularity. And I ran down a list of, you know, you need to settle the whole Rodman Dam issue once and for all, tear the dam down. You need to issue orders to enact the other 80% of the recommendations from your blue-green algae task force that the legislature very conveniently ignored. And in order to clean up Florida's waterways, you need to kill these two projects that are threatening the future of the Florida Panther and, you know, say that you're in favor of a statewide heat protection ordinance for outdoor workers. Those seem like no-brainers to me, quite honestly. And I'm not going to claim credit for this, but I see that the very first event the governor did when he got back in town, when he got back to Florida, he went to a ribbon cutting for an Everglades project. So it's like,
I noticed that.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Well, but, you know, he's also lining up behind the governor of Texas to, you know, attempt to make the southern border with Mexico more of a death zone.
Yeah, you know, starting a new civil war. Just think about how well that last one worked out. That's not the future, man.
I hope he takes your advice. I expect him to race further right in the culture war topics and terrorize trans kids and ban more books and destroy more universities.
That makes him less popular, not more popular. So if he wants to run for another office, say, for instance, Marco Rubio's Senate seat in a couple of years, he needs to rebuild his popularity, and he's not going to do it with that stuff.
He terms out as governor
23 years. He's had three more years.
Yeah. FloridaPhoenix.com. You can check Craig's work out there. All right. We've got another one for music lovers. We've done Elvis in Florida. We've done R&B music in Florida, Southern Rock, the Allman Brothers. We've talked to Del Suggs on a previous episode. We've done the Beatles in Florida. But today, if there is one music artist most associated with the state, to me, it's Tom Petty in Gainesville.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been wanting to do this for a while and finally made contact with Warren Zanes, who wrote the biography of Tom Petty and knew him and actually played with him. And Warren agreed to come talk to us about that. And I can't say enough nice things about this book because it gives you all sorts of insight into Tom's really rough childhood and how he became who he became. This sort of unlikely figure. I mean, he definitely doesn't look like a rock star. Doesn't sound like a rock star, but he sure became one.
I always worry in these episodes that I know are more, you know, all the episodes I like, some are more important than the others because they cover such a crucial topic to the state's history. And I like to think of this podcast as kind of a 1,000-piece puzzle that when completed, puts together a full and complete picture of the state of Florida. We recorded our interview with Warren prior to this introduction. It met all of my expectations. This is the Tom Petty episode I was hoping we'd be able to do.
Warren, thanks so much for joining us today. This is your book is so fascinating. I learned so much stuff I didn't know. Tell me about Tom Petty's family. I don't think people really know this about his Native American heritage.
Yeah, I remember The first time I met Tom Petty was, I can't remember the year, but I was still a teenager. So we go back, quite a ways. And I met him in a number of different contexts. But that was something I knew about him, that he had said he was a quarter Cherokee in interviews. And you could kind of see it in his bone structure to some degree. But I think he's one of the many American stories of a kind of cultural cross-fertilization that's far more common than a lot of people will talk about.
Yeah.
And, I always liked that Petty did. And he didn't obscure his past in ways that, he felt might serve him. I think he was very authentic to his experience, and a lot of it had a pretty rough quality.
In what respect?
Well, particularly his relationship with his father. He was, when he talked to me about it, he was so unguarded. But, one of the key Florida moments in my interviews with him, it came when I was, before I was his biographer, I was just a kid who had quit his rock and roll band. And we're sitting in Tom's office, and I'm 22, 23? And we're sitting there, and we smoked some pot. My mother grew incredible pot, and Petty loved it. And so we're in his office, just the two of us, and I started talking as a guy who had quit his rock and roll band about what I was going to do next and, put a band together out there in Los Angeles. And Petty looked at me and said, "This isn't where bands come from. Like, you got to go back home." And why that was pertinent to me as his biographer was, that's where he still put Gainesville. Like, they weren't a Los Angeles band, they were a Gainesville band. Relocated to Los Angeles.
That's a great point. And it's remarkable when you think about, not only did Tom Petty come from Gainesville, okay, lead singers can come from anywhere, all over, but his entire band came from this tiny little town, and they were all remarkable players and largely stayed together. That's what I think is the most extraordinary thing about the story. Gainesville didn't produce Tom Petty. It produced Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
It's always interesting to me. Let's take, Mike Campbell.
Yeah.
Where did Good Mike example. Campbell get that remarkable sense of taste? The way Mike Campbell plays to the song, because there are plenty of moments where Mike Campbell could be doing a hell of a lot more in a song's production. And where did he get that innate sense for where to play less, where to, make it minimal? There's no class for that. And that there's also a Benmont Tench in that band who can do the same thing on keyboards. And that Tom Petty, as a songwriter, who didn't come out of the box as the obvious lead singer and songwriter, like he worked his way there. But how did those two guys find that guy? It's hard.
Yeah.
For me, it's like, if you want evidence of the existence of God, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers are a pretty good place to start.
I look forward to my minister delivering that sermon. Tell us about, before we leave this behind, tell us about his relationship with his dad and how that sort of shaped him.
In the content that he gave me, that, there were stories that didn't go into the book. It was more of a question. You're writing a book, you want to figure out, okay, what's the best scene that depicts the violence that he experienced? And the word best scene feels awkward just saying it, because there's nothing good about violence between a father and his son. But it was absolutely crucial to convey. I don't think you can understand Tom Petty's ambitions without understanding the deeper disconnection between a father and son that is the result of, in part, that violence. You know, it's like if you take father-son conflict out of the story of rock and roll, you're probably going to lose like 60% of it. There are a lot of major figures in popular music who are, through music, making some statement about themselves that challenges how they felt in relation to that, you know, parent-child dynamic. You know, when a parent is violent toward a child, there's a lot of breakage to contend with in the adult years. And Petty did it through me.
Yeah, and you mentioned the one time where his dad beat him so mercilessly that his mom and his grandmother were treating, he had welts all over his body, basically, from head to toe, and they were...
Yeah, so that was the scene I chose. Mm-hmm. You know, there were others. And, you know, it's a strange predicament to be in because I grew up just loving Tom Petty so much from before I was a teenager. You know, WBCN, I grew up in New Hampshire. WBCN was our real big local rock station coming out of Boston. And that was one of the key stations that broke the Heartbreakers when they, you know, they re-released Breakdown. They took a second round on it. So we were there from the beginning as fans. And so to be interviewing and kind of looking for these stories that hurt so much is a strange place to be, but you're there because it helps people to understand where these songs came from, you know.
Was his father an alcoholic, just a mean guy? I mean, you know, Petty as a kid, and he's not a bad kid. What initiated this violence, this abuse?
You know, this is where I step back, and it's more, you know, my own analysis. But, you know, rare is the case where you see violence like that, where it doesn't go back multiple generations.
Yeah.
You know the saying, hurt people.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned about in the car crash that injured his mom, that his dad had been drinking pretty early that day.
Yeah. I mean, where there's trouble, there's often booze. And mm-hmm. where there's trouble, there's often a history of a chain of hurt that goes back. You know, part of me, you know, that's what I come from. You know, there's a lot of alcoholism in my family. I'm 30 years in recovery myself. My father abandoned me. It's not that I had to have those qualifications to write a book about someone who had related experiences, mm-hmm. but I think it tuned me up. And I think I learned a lot about myself when I looked into Tom Petty's experiences as a boy and as a young man.
Hmm. It was interesting too to see how much of it was cultural, that his dad was into like hunting and fishing, and Tom clearly was not. He wasn't into sports. He would never tell his parents about any girls he was dating. So his dad became concerned about him being gay. it's just amazing stuff.
Yeah, but that's where like he's you know, I'd say his dad was beginning from a good place, which is I want to prepare my son for the world he's walking into. And from his father's perspective, you know, that world, it was like measured in relation to a certain kind of masculinity.
Mm.
Hunt, you fish, you take no shit, you know, and this is where, but the world had changed.
Yeah.
You know, the 50s became the 60s and things were different. And so the father's teachings become a breakdown in communication between these two men who ultimately, you know, the dad loves his son, but doesn't know how to be a father in that context.
To what extent were they able to repair their relationship later in life?
You know, I don't know how you repair that stuff, but, you know, he would talk fondly of his father you know, and I think his father, you know, his father would wear a Heartbreakers jacket. He wasn't betting on his son, but once he lost that bet and his son became Tom Petty, he was proud of that.
Yeah. I should have guessed this, but I had no idea he was such a bad student in school. He just hated school and would much rather hang out with his friends. But the stories of his odd jobs, I thought were pretty good. I had no idea he had worked at a funeral home in St. Petersburg. That was and lived there too.
You know, what's funny is, and this holds for Tom Petty, this holds for the members of the Beatles. They might not have done well in the informal education, but they were driven by this intellectual curiosity. I think that that was like, you know, taking George Harrison and Tom Petty. Why were those guys drawn together? I think because they've got this kind of autodidact quality, and they become incredibly cosmopolitan. No matter that, you know, lack of formal education, they get an education that can beat out any formal education. It's just, it arrives through experience. It arrives through, you know, contact. You know, the Beatles come from a working class Liverpool, and, you know, they end up, you know, being able to talk about Eastern cultures, the avant-garde, you know, fashion and art. And Tom was a similar thing.
Yeah. Getting back to his father, none of which goes real far in 1950s Gainesville. But, you know, as, you know, the culture and the society evolves, you know, it does. And I think when you look at people like that, and obviously his songwriting, you see this great empathy and a real observer of humanity and the human condition. And that is not an education or an intellect that can be measured on a standardized test, right? But Tom Petty and those artists clearly have an intelligence that is atypical to, you know, coming up through primary school ranks the way we do it in the United States.
Rock and roll can be one hell of a good education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with an individual who's got some ambitions and whose life is transformed by the music, they go into it in such a way that a remarkable education can unfold. And Petty's he's just a prime example. But I think there is a connection between that violence experienced in childhood and the empathy that made him a great songwriter. It comes at a very high cost, but there's a reason we all connect with these songs. It was incredible. After he passed, it was hard not to go, damn, I wish he could be around to see some of this. Mm-hmm. Because he was beloved, but so many people came forward demonstrating how beloved.
Yeah, isn't that always the case with people who die young like that? You always think, oh, well, you know, he died in his late 60s. Oh, he's got another 20 years, you know, and then you realize how deeply he touched so many people who had never expressed that before. He died in 2017 very suddenly. We'll get into that later on. But yes, he meant a great deal to a lot of people who he had no idea he meant a great deal to. To get back to the childhood thing, which I think is fascinating, how did he allow this abuse not to defeat him for the rest of his life? You mentioned ambition. So many people, sadly, who suffer like this are ruined by it. He obviously was able to overcome it. What in his character, nature, nurture provided for him to break free of that and prosper in the incredible way he would go on to do?
You know, again, this is more on the speculative side, but, you know, maybe that toughness that his father wanted him to have came out in a form different from what his father was trying to instill in him. And it was just that tenacity like that. Because it's funny, I was just talking to my brother on the phone about this. And, you know, you interview enough artists and it becomes very clear that nobody's hitting it first time around. It's the people who end up having careers are the ones who get really good at dusting themselves off and getting back in the saddle. Mm. Yeah. That's definitely Tom Petty. And so some, you know, tenacious quality, I feel like maybe did go back to his father. You know, there was a toughness and God, where does self-belief come from when you're going through those tough experiences in childhood? Maybe right. The self-belief was his mother's. I don't think it's an easy equation, but he had some self-belief. He had some confidence, didn't come from teachers in school, often didn't come from his dad, maybe his mother, maybe another place. I don't know. Maybe he just so fell in love with this music that he was bound and determined to be a part of it. Maybe it's that he watched enough Westerns that he was like, the underdogs will ultimately get their shot.
Even the losers get lucky sometimes.
Yeah, totally. I really wanted to call my biography Even the Losers. Yeah. But, you know, there are marketplace demands. But
yeah.
If there's a title, if you could not think about the marketplace, it would totally be Even the
I wonder, too, if it was that encounter with Elvis, who was in Florida filming Follow That Dream, and Tom met him. I wonder if that glimpse of possible future glory was what drove him, too, that he saw what could be when he met Elvis.
When Tom Zimney was making the movie The Searcher about Elvis, I did some interviews for that. And I said, you know, you just have to get Tom Petty. Because when Tom Petty talks about Elvis, it's nothing is better. You know, because Tom Petty doesn't have to talk about Tom Petty. And his love for Elvis is so deep and pure. And so, yeah, it's hard not to imagine like some, you know, damn near like biblical moment of like seeing Elvis, something registering. Tom talked about it in very elevated terms. I remember him like, you know, he was, you know, he's a rock star. Yeah. So he's in the man who has everything category, but he was collecting Elvis EPs.
Really?
I remember showing these, like, I got the last, now I have them all. You know, it still mattered to him. You know, imagine being that age and actually meeting the unmeetable Elvis. Yeah. Surely it had some, but I think we can't really completely arrive at the equation that gave this kid who nobody was betting on the fuel he needed to become what he became. It would be a speculative thing, and I'm sure it's multiple elements.
Yeah. What was the moment, and I guess if, and this always fascinates me too, this idea of, okay, here we are in Gainesville, a bunch of guys, let's drive to Los Angeles and become professional musicians, which is akin to going to the moon at that point in a business that is notoriously difficult to get into. Why did they think they were equal to this challenge?
But before we get to that, I just want to bring up, so he was in what, the Epics? And then yep. Mud Crutch, Epics became Mud Crutch, and then eventually Mud Crutch became the Heartbreakers. But there were a lot of bands around back then that I didn't realize that guys who were connected to the Eagles came out of Gainesville. And, of course, Stephen Stills came from Gainesville. Yeah. So they could see that people from Gainesville would go and become successful.
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. Like, okay. You know, like Bernie Ledden, you know, Tom Ledden is in the group with Tom Petty, and they watched Bernie go do it and join the Eagles. You know, so there are a few examples like this can happen. It's like winning the lottery, but it can happen. Sometimes there's a lot of beauty in not having a plan B. You know, like, was he going to go back and dig graves? You know, yeah. You're going to work at a funeral home? No, there was no plan B. And so that too can become a special kind of thrust. Yeah, it's when you hear about that story of like driving out there, the moment I always loved, and Tom Petty would talk about this, is like being in LA and looking up the numbers for the record companies. And he sees a scrap of paper on the ground, and it's like, it's a list of all the numbers for the record companies, you know, written in ballpoint pen. And he's like, you know, of two minds. One is, oh, great, I don't have to look all these up. And the other is like, oh, shit, how many people have done this before me? But then he gets bites. And it's both a surprise and not a surprise, because there are already like glimmers of what this could be. There's an emerging voice. And there are people out there who are good at, you know, hearing something and going, it may not quite be there, but I hear something. You know, they're listening to enough demos to know this has some trace of the thing I'm looking for. So it goes on this pile, and most of it goes on that pile.
Yeah. Yeah. At his peak, and again, we kind of all take for granted that, you know, Tom Petty was a big rock star. But, you know, he's one of those guys who the song seemed to be a factory setting in the American mindset, you know, whether it's Breakdown, Free Falling, you know, that was, you know, when I was in high school, you know, Free Falling, Last Dance with Mary Jane, just on the radio constantly. And then there was the Stevie Nicks material, when Stevie Nicks coming out of Fleetwood Mac was maybe the biggest musical star in the world. At his peak, how big did Petty get?
Well, I mean, Full Moon Fever was a kind of peak, but he also, you know, the biggest tour was the last tour. So he became,
yeah, good point.
At a certain point, you're going project to project in the beginning, and it's measured by how did the singles off an album do. But the rare artist becomes that kind of legacy artist. It's, you know, Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Nicks, where they can do a tour and it doesn't hinge on the most recent release. There's Petty with hits in three decades. That's a legacy artist.
And then to go out and be the backup band for Bob Dylan on tour, and then do the Traveling Wilburys, where he's joining with these legends, you know, Roy Orbison and George Harrison and so forth.
That's right. When we toured with him, was in between the Dylan tours.
Yeah.
And they made Let Me Up, I've Had Enough, which was their worst selling record, that had, you know, Runaway Trains on it. Great record. I mean, they're all great records. His Petty's quality level is unassailable. Like, there's not a bad record.
Yeah.
It was the worst selling record. Mm. But it was right in between their Dylan tours. We went out and did a 3-month summer tour, and it was my band, the Del Fuegos, the George Satellites, and the Heartbreakers. It was a moment where you got to see Petty experiencing a record that didn't go particularly well. And having this experience of being a backing band for Dylan, which is both a great thing, but also like, are we a backing band?
Yeah.
It does, even if they were playing their own show before the show with Dylan, it's still like, it was a period of uncertainty. This is what I love about the shape of Petty's career, is then the next thing is the biggest thing. There's this maximum number of questions of like, who am I? What is this band? Where are we heading? And then just sheer chance and the draw that Tom Petty was to other human beings like Bob Dylan and George Harrison. Harrison comes into his life, Jeff Lynne, Traveling Wilburys form. And getting to know Jeff Lynne better, they start working on Full Moon Fever. And you get to watch Tom Petty go into his biggest moment yet. right after he's asking questions of, did we peak? Is this going to keep going? Like, what's happening? And he's willing to take some chances. Like, one is like, I'm going to work without my band, no matter how identified I am with them. I'm going to co-write with somebody who isn't Mike Campbell, you know, working with Jeff Lynne. You know, he did this repeatedly in his career, like was willing to leap off a few cliffs. And I think that's one way you become a legacy artist.
He also had a real conscience. And I find his locking horns with the record industry over the price of albums a fascinating chapter of his kind of defense of music fans in a respect.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the biggest stars in popular music, part of what got them there and keeps them there is they never stop identifying as fans. They know what they come from, and that keeps them connected to their own fans. But Petty was fully capable of being a 17-year-old with, you know, $4 and some change in his pocket, desperate to buy a record. He was still connected to that kid. And so when they're trying to raise the price on his back, he was quick to take note and say, not on my name. Go do it with somebody else.
After he died, there was a posthumous release that included some songs he'd written, including one called Gainesville, which is now kind of my favorite Tom Petty song. I wish they'd released it while he was alive. Did he often talk about his home and about, you know, his experiences and it playing at Dubs? You know,
no, totally. You know, what's interesting about, and I really picked this up when I was working at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I do a lot of interviews with artists. And if you want to engage an artist, talk to them about their life before they got famous. I remember being on the Heartbreakers plane on tour with them. And if they got engaged as a group in a conversation, it was inevitably about some funny thing back in Gainesville. like the Dubs stories never got old to them. You know? That too, I think, can keep a band glued together. You know, to remember we got here, but we came from there.
And yeah.
Petty was so conscious. That's why I say, you know, if you were to ask him, are you an LA band or are you a Gainesville band? I think he would say we're a Gainesville band.
Yeah.
Because that's where they did the most crucial becoming.
How often did he go back later in life?
They had like a summer kind of place, like a beach house that they would go to. But I couldn't answer that with any kind of authority. Mm-hmm. And I know it wasn't just a spiritual umbilical cord that kept them connected. They went back.
Yeah. You know, he certainly is Southern and never backed away from that. But he's also not associated with the South, I don't think, anyways, to the extent that a Southern rock musician like Leonard Skinner or the Allman Brothers or something like that would be. How was he able to incorporate that definitely into his sound, but also transcend it to be more mainstream, popular rock and roll as opposed to just one of these niche Southern rock, even like a ZZ Top or something like that?
You know, I think he wrote very widely. I think the writing itself detached him from that, you know, and he loved that, you know, they did gigs with Leonard Skinner and there were friendships there. So it wasn't that they were seeking to not be connected to that. I just think, you know, like when you think about Don't Come Around Here No More, there he is feeling very natural working with Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics. And that's on a record called Southern Accents.
Yeah, yeah. That song is one of the most unusual pop hits ever. Nothing, I mean, to me, It's one of my top five favorite songs of his. And if you put all the component pieces together, it looks like a hyena. It's like all these parts that shouldn't fit together. It's like, how in the world with the sitar? Yep. And I mean, it's just the most bizarre. But I think it shows his genius, his flexibility in a way, his that's genius to put all of those pieces together and come up with that whole. It's just remarkable. Yep.
Great video,
too. No one would listen to that and say, oh, that's a Southern band.
Exactly.
It's like, so he can both write to, you know, take a song like Trailer that they, you know, redid with Mudcrutch later on. You can kind of begin to situate that geographically, but there's so much of his output that you couldn't situate geographically. I think there's a proud Southern connection. But there's also an artist who always found ways to explore, you know, what's just over the hill from here.
Yeah, and you talk about that Southern Accents album, Southern Accents, the single, speaks to that beautifully. I mean, it is one of the better songs ever written about what it means to be from the South. Johnny Cash recorded it. It's not a hit, you know, so to speak. It's not really a radio song, but it really does tenderly and authentically describe, you know, the where I come from with a Southern accent. You know, it couldn't be more different than Don't Come Around Here No More.
If you need evidence of the level at which he was writing, that song will serve you well. I mean, let's set the music aside. If you want to see the power he had as a writer, that's a great example. A really good writer. I think sometimes people might miss that because he did it with such economy and it was never showy, but he had a real natural gift. And, you know, I think like Dylan being attracted to him is Dylan being attracted to a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Difficult question to answer, obviously. And last one for me, what does he mean to American music?
I put him in the category of like the Buddy Hollies and the Hank Williams, creating a big catalog of songs that have a kind of, we can drop into them. A lot of them we can drop into. It's not like the vocal range is prohibitive. It doesn't, even if the structure and the composition are demanding, it doesn't feel demanding. Like Buddy Holly, we could bust out a half a dozen Buddy Holly songs pretty easily and take them to the campfire. Hank Williams, same thing. Tom Petty had that ease. And what's interesting about that ease is when people do get into it, then they come in touch with the complexity. It's often deceiving. They're more complicated than they feel, but that ease, like you got this feeling of like, this stuff just pours out of this guy. And I don't think it actually did. I think he worked like a dog for those songs, you know. But that's what puts him with the Hank Williams and Buddy Hollies of the world. And, you know, we can look at Motown and go see all those great writers and those great songs. But there are a lot of writing teams and they're very conscious of what they're doing. Hank Williams, Buddy Holly, Tom Petty, these are individuals who had a kind of style that was, you know, not completely all their own, but it was their own, like an identifiable thing. And then that ease, it kind of welcomes not just the listener in, but the person who wants to play themselves. And so after Tom died, I think there were a lot of musicians who stepped forward and were ready to say, I don't think I'd be doing this today if it wasn't for that guy.
Yeah. After he died, the University of Florida, where he was never a student. He worked on the grounds crew. The students started singing, I Won't Back Down at the football games. And it became sort of this, you know, it's like the Sweet Caroline for the Boston Red Sox. What would he think if he was, if he saw that today, that, you know, this place that where he was, they basically, he was forced to quit because they didn't like him, and now they're accepting him so much.
I have no doubt that it would be meaningful to him. Like anybody who writes a song is ultimately looking to communicate. I just hope that, you know, when somebody exits stage left, that they still have some sense for what happens after they leave. And I hope that he had some experience after he died of the outpouring of love and respect that came, because it was more than deserved. Like, this is a guy who, it's tough being a band leader, so he had a tough side. I know that guy was incredibly good to me. He gave me some experiences that I'm not entirely sure I was, I earned them after he gave them to me, but he took a leap of faith in me and it changed my life. But he was that kind of guy who, if he had a gut feeling, he was going to go with them. And that it changed the lives of some people whose paths he crossed. And, you know, I was just lucky to be, you know, somewhere in the middle of that list. I think he would smile down on the scene, because when you write a song, you want it to get out there and do the maximum amount of communicating it can do. And he was a great fucking communicator.
Yeah, he's got about a dozen of them that are going to live forever as long as people listen to music. Warren Zanes is Tom Petty's biographer. The book Petty, the biography, tompettybook.com. I'll have links to all that in the show notes. This has lived up to the subject. Thank you so much, Warren.
Thank you both.
Thanks, Warren. Appreciate it.
We talked about this before, I think it was one of our bonus episodes at patreon.com for the patrons, how much we both enjoy Tom Petty's music. And I found him much later in life. Again, I grew up on 80s pop and rock radio, so Petty was always a fixture, but not one of my favorites, really, until I was in my 40s and rediscovered him through his Sirius XM channel, Tom Petty Radio, where he did,
which is a great channel, yeah.
Where, you know, he did so much of the voice work himself and hosted shows and really brought fans into his personal record collection and so many live concerts that they aired. And I, you know, he died in 2017. I remember the day and hearing it on the radio, and I forget what I was going through at the time, but it was very difficult. And all I could just think was, God, I could have done without that today. Yeah. You know, and I know that's a trite explanation or summation. He was not a young man. I mean, he was 67, but that's hardly old. Yeah. And
he still had plenty more years left of
creativity. Oh my goodness. And like Warren said, you know, his biggest concert tours were towards the end. I think there were people like myself, again, there were certainly younger people than me discovering him, but there were also people like myself who were gaining a richer appreciation for him that they hadn't previously. And when you run down the songs, brother, Free Fallin', American Girl, The Waiting, Don't Come Around Here No More, You Don't Know How It Feels, Stop Dragging My Heart Around, the duet with Stevie Nicks, Won't Back Down, like you mentioned at the Florida games, Running Down a Dream. These songs exist in like the ether of the American culture. They can't be pulled out. They are inseparable in that this guy came from Gainesville. And I didn't know the full extent of the relationship with his father that Warren talked about. What a remarkable, remarkable gift Florida gave to the world in Tom Petty.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I told this story on the bonus episode that I actually saw him in concert.
Yes.
In Tampa. And it was a great concert. But the thing that I really remember is he brought out Roger McGuinn from the Byrds to play with him, because Roger McGuinn was living here in Florida at the time. And the drunk guy behind me, who had been somewhat disruptive up to that point, got really excited and started yelling, "Free Bird, Free Bird," because he completely misunderstood who the Byrds were. So welcome to Florida.